Stanford University and KZSU. This is the Stanford Storytelling Project.
So, if it turns out that the brain is a quantum object with enough recursion built into the object is sufficient to give rise to what we think of as awareness, I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
You know that moment in high school physics class when the teacher holds up a piece of chalk and asks you what will happen if he lets go? It's that classic demonstration of the scientific method. Hypothesis, observation, and experiment. The teacher drops the chalk and it falls to the floor, and he explains Newton's law of gravity. That seemed straightforward to me, but a simple question stayed in my mind. What exactly is gravity? What is it that's pulling the chalk to the floor? I let these questions go until taking a physics course here in my freshman year at Stanford. We were talking about the basic equations of Newton, and suddenly the question came back to me. What is gravity? I asked the professor, and he said, "Well, there are a number of theories about this, but to be honest, nobody really knows." And I said, "What?" And he said, "One theory is that there are these little particles called gravitons that go between object and object. And if they exist, they must not have mass, because gravitational force has an unlimited range." Graviton? How come I'd never heard that word before? And how could a particle exist if it doesn't have mass? So I began to wonder, if physics hasn't explained such a basic thing as gravity, it seems like there are some pretty basic questions that science hasn't explained. There are other basic phenomena like this, on both the really small and the really large scale. Take consciousness, for example. Our mechanical understanding of the brain is improving every day, but we're still on the hunt for that thing that makes a system of neurons animate and self-aware. In other words, for all that we know, we don't even know what we are. And maybe, like so many things, science just needs more time. And given our history of progress, we can expect some better explanations in the future. Or maybe our science has taken a wrong turn somewhere. Whether it's a matter of methodology or the basic framework itself, maybe we have so many unanswered questions because we're not asking the right questions. This is the Stanford Storytelling Project, and I'm Bonnie Swift. And today we have a special one-hour show about the edges of science, or research that is taking place outside the contemporary parameters of science. I've come to think of this genre of research as parascience. Our focus will be primarily on research about consciousness, research that falls a little bit outside of what is normally considered scientific domain, but which is nevertheless done according to scientific method. After that first physics class at Stanford, I wondered, if our science had taken a wrong turn somewhere, when had this happened? And I spent the rest of my 4 years here learning about the history and philosophy of science. Both scientists and historians have helped me understand how our cultural climate sways our perception of what is and what is not allowed within the gates of the academic garden. In my time exploring the history of science, I discovered that the relationship between science and mysticism goes far back into history. Most of our scientific forefathers, Kepler, Newton, Galileo, especially Newton, were fascinated by the occult. And I discovered that in Newton's time, and up until very recently actually, the distinctions between natural and supernatural, or between science and pseudoscience, were still being formulated. In Newton's time, there was still a willingness to entertain all the various possible explanations for things. Scientists with this outlook have largely disappeared. But there are a few who remain. Some physicists and philosophers today are calling for a return to a more holistic science, one with an expanded, more open-ended framework. Even into the early part of the 20th century, there were still active debates in science about psychic phenomena and the nature of things. And this is a conversation that professors now tend to steer clear of. Metaphysics has been relegated to the seminary. When I started this project, I began to look around for people who would know about the history of parapsychological research. I thought that I might have to go as far as London to find something interesting, but it turns out I didn't even have to leave campus. In the early 1900s, Stanford had a special fellowship designated for what they called psychical or spiritualist research, and I thought this might be a good place to start. Money for psychical research was donated to Stanford in 1911 by Leland Stanford's younger brother, Thomas Welton. He had a personal interest in spiritualism and sent the university large sums of money, as well as his collection of ceremonious objects. These objects are now housed in the special collections of our library. University historian and archivist Maggie Kimball showed me these mysterious objects one day last week.
So, among the various apports that are in the collection, there are things like an ink block, and there are also numerous boxes of seeds and rocks. These are objects that are purported to have appeared during seances or were introduced at a seance and then somehow were altered during the course of the seance period. The ink block is basically what looks like a black block of stone with an indentation at one end on the top for the ink, would have been used for writing purposes. It's in a box with other objects, which may well be items. There's a wooden piece with markings on one side, a leather piece at the end, almost like a hanging. And on the back is a date, December 7th, 06. So this would have been an object that would have likely appeared during a seance on that date. Actually, many of the seances that Thomas Welton Stanford participated in were actually held in his home in Melbourne, Australia. He was interested in working with several different mediums to communicate with those in the world beyond. It's questionable how much he believed all of what some of the mediums produced or indicated occurred during those seances, but he continued to sort of pursue the interest in spiritualism, as did many others in Australia and elsewhere at the time.
Thomas Welton, as I mentioned before, was the younger brother of Leland Stanford. And both boys grew up in a small town in New York and came out west to make their fortunes. And while Leland decided to stay in California, Thomas Welton decided to move to Australia, where he established a monopoly on the sale of Singer sewing machines. He was described as a somewhat Uncle Sam-looking man, tall and slender with swarthy skin and dark hair. He always wore a long-tailed coat and was especially proud of his long beard, which he bundled into a bag while he worked in the garden.
Physically, the photographs of him with a long beard and sort of long hair make him look almost Rasputin-like. And I think he was he was considered a character to some extent, but he clearly cared deeply about the university. And there's, as I said, I think there's some speculation as to how real he really thought these mediums were, but I think there was also a real need for people to be able to participate in things like that at the time.
When it came to his interest in spiritualism, Thomas Welton was not alone in the Stanford family. Jane Stanford, Leland's wife, was also interested in the possibility of communicating with the dead. And both Thomas Welton and Jane were drawn to this idea, especially after the death of someone dear to them.
Many people basically sort of take his interest in spiritualism as Jane Stanford's interest back to the death of a loved one. Thomas Welton Stanford traveled to Australia with a brother, DeWitt Stanford, who died shortly after they arrived in Australia. But Thomas Welton Stanford married a young woman who died in the first year of their marriage, some say with child, but that's not been necessarily proven. But it was his interest in communicating with his wife that prompted this interest. Jane Stanford, I think, was also interested in at least exploring the idea of being able to communicate with her son. And much has been made out of that interest, and what people forget is that it was a little odd even at the time, but it was much more accepted than it is today. And the kind of intense feeling of loss was something that people experienced and dealt with in a much different way than that kind of loss might be today.
After I spoke with Maggie, I spent some time in the archives, and I came across some interesting newspaper articles published around the turn of the century. In one, a typical séance was described. Door locked, key secured. The sensitive, or medium, was first searched and enveloped in a bag which was tied tightly and sealed. Lights were extinguished, and three objects immediately fell with a great deal of noise on the floor. Then there was a rattling resembling the chink of small metals, and the control handed me what he described as valuable ancient coins brought from Egypt. His exact words were, "Dead men's money from Egypt. Very old. Very scarce." There were 7 coins. Strangely enough, when I went to visit Maggie Kimball, she pulled out a box of coins.
So this envelope actually includes a number of different items, coins, and what looked like, this looks like a small, maybe lead scarab. These are actually a lot more interesting than the rocks, which just look like rocks. A lot of the objects tended to have some kind of relationship to the ancient world. So there's papyrus in the collection. These Arabic coins might be considered to be certainly from a much earlier era. It's almost as though it was some way of asserting that these objects came from a much different time than these people were living in when they were participating in the seance.
In the course of his lifetime, Thomas Welton donated more than $750,000 to the university. This was a substantial endowment in those days. And in his will, Thomas Welton specified that the fund should be used for, quote, "learning and general knowledge in connection with psychical or psychological study or research." I was curious about how those funds are used now, and I wrote to the dean of the psychology department. And the reference that the dean sent me in reply said that the lawyers interpreted the term psychological research to mean the general study of psychology. So Thomas Welton's endowment was then incorporated into a larger fund, which provided most of the department's budgets in the following decades. Often, the distribution of funding shows us what is and what is not acceptable to study, and the fate of Thomas Welton's endowment reflects, perhaps, how the academic climate has changed in the past 100 years.